Very good. So people can get their seats and I'll start. There's still people coming in. If you haven't got the sheet here, there's a sheet, still some sheets left on the table over there. Because sometimes I teach from, it's best to get the sheets as well because I've got a retranslated it. So you can follow it from the book, but you'll find the book is not the same as the text from which I'm going to read from. They're all gone. I've got two more sheets here. Two more here. Who wants another? Two more here, Lynn. If anyone needs some more. Here we go. Young man. We put it on the bottom there anyway. On the table. Thank you. That's a very good guess, Lynn. You just printed enough. You can share. Okay. Here we go. So welcome everybody to today's, Priya's coming in. Is to today's sutta class, and today we're going to be doing the first half of one of the deeper suttas, the dependent origination. It's number 15 of the Digha Nikaya. And just to let people know, because it's a very powerful teaching and a very, very difficult sutta. I was telling people earlier when I told Ajahn Bhamali that I was going to do the Digha Nikaya Mahanidana Sutta, dependent origination sutta today. He turned to me and said, "You must be crazy, Ajahn Bhamali." Because it is a difficult one. But I don't know, it's nice to actually to give you the full range of suttas. And often all the easy ones we've all done. So now I'm trying to get into a few more which are more deep. So begin to be able to be done in one day. And in 2 weeks' time, the fourth Sunday of this month is the 22nd. It's Waisak weekend. So we can't do it that day, but we have a fifth Sunday this weekend. So the second part of this sutta class will be on the 29th of May. It'll be the fifth Sunday of the month. So I'll be here then and I can finish it off on that day, the 29th. So I only expect to go halfway through this today. So okay, most people are here now. And you get the last one. Yes, you better take that. Oh, that's Vince. That's the last one. Excellent. Then you just printed enough. So here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namasami. So today we're going to be starting with the Buddha's dependent origination. Again, it is very deep, and I'll tell you why it was made especially deep in a moment. And anyone who knows all the 12 links of dependent origination might notice, if you can count, there's only 9 links in this version. And very often that it is understood the first 2 links of dependent origination in the forward order, delusion or avijja, and the sankhara, often called the karma formations, they are sometimes missed out because you can understand dependent origination beginning just from the working together of consciousness and its objects of consciousness, which is called the nama-rupa, materiality and mentality. However, what is quite surprising in this sutta, you may notice that which is there in other places, called the sixth sense basis, is actually missing from here. Why it's missing? Just shows you that the way that you can describe this cause and effect relationship called dependent origination, you know, it's not so specific. You can look at it in many different ways. And in this particular way, the sixth sense basis actually is included in one of the other factors. Anyway, I'll just warn you about that, and you'll see that as we go along. So here we are. I'll start, and then when it's the appropriate time, I will pause so you can ask questions. And again, this one I've retranslated myself to make it where I can, to make it a little more easy to understand, and also to give a little bit more indication of some of the meanings of these words, which they can be translated many, many different ways. And you have my translation from the Pali here. So here we go. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Buddha was living among the Kurus in a town called Kamasadhamma, which was supposed to be towards the north of India. They say somewhere actually between Agra and Delhi was where they said it could possibly be, but certainly outside of the usual area of the Ganges Valley, much further upstream. And there the Venerable Ananda approached the Buddha, paid homage to him, sat down on one side and said, "It is wonderful and marvelous, Venerable Sir, how this dependent origination is so profound and appears so deep. Yet to me, it seems as clear as can be." And this is my translation, as you can probably read in the next paragraph. "Steady on, old chap, steady on." Because that is translating what the Buddha said in the Indian and putting it in an English version. And that's what he would have said if he was English. And this is important when you do translations, to make it actually what it means in that modern society. And also it gives a bit of humour, which is good. "Steady on, old chap, steady on. This dependent origination is profound and appears deep. Because of not understanding and not penetrating this Dhamma, this teaching of dependent origination, Ananda, this generation has become entangled like a knotted ball of thread, like rushes and reeds all matted, so that few become free from the cycle of rebirth." So it's trying to get this metaphor of being so caught up, so entangled, like knotted balls of thread, you can't really untangle yourself from life. And because it starts off with Ananda saying, "Oh, it's so simple and easy to understand," I think this is the one reason why the Buddha really gets into this in a very, very profound way. You know, just to teach Ananda and everyone else a lesson that this dependent origination is in fact very, very very deep and extremely profound. And it's sometimes that some of the things which you're going to read here, or I'm going to say, are going to be testing your brains. So let's go on the start. He starts usually off with just a summary of dependent origination, and then he goes into each little connection, each link, as they say, in more detail. So we start with a summary. And starting in the backwards area, starting with aging and death, which the Buddha would always equate with suffering. Ananda, if one is asked, "Are aging and death due to a specific cause?" one should say they are. If one is asked, "What is the cause of aging and death?" one should answer, "Birth is the cause of aging and death." Which sounds simplistic, but when you understand, as I mentioned a few seconds ago, that the aging and death was seen by the Buddha as an essential suffering which no one can really escape from. You can escape from sort of the problems of a marriage or the problems of finances, but aging and death is something which no one can escape from. And it's caused by birth. And that particular link by itself should make it very clear that the goal of the spiritual path is to end birth. That's the only way you can end aging and death. If you get born again, you're going to have to go through this all over again. So it's the birth is the problem. And if one is asked, "Is birth due to a specific cause?" one should say, "Yes, it is." If one is asked, "What is the cause of birth?" one should answer, and this is my translation, "States of existences," which is places where you can be reborn into, are the cause of birth. You actually need a place to get reborn into. And this is the word called bawa. And sometimes it has some really weird translations. The most weird, which is totally unacceptable according to the Pali, is when people call it becoming. Becoming sounds nice, but it's got nothing to do with actually the word bawa. It does mean an existence. And you see in a few moments when we go through each of these links in detail, get some understanding of what this actually is. It is a state of existence, a place where you can be reborn into. And if one is asked, are states of existence due to a specific cause? One should say they are. If one is asked, what is the cause for these states of existence? One should answer, a word called upadana, which means fuel, sometimes translated as attachment or clinging, which again sounds good, but it's not the real meaning when you actually see how it's explained. And it's one of the reasons why, in brackets here, I put the explanation, which is coming a bit later, of what it actually means, the fuel. And the fuel, the thing which creates states of existence, are the five senses, wrong views, rites and rituals, and most importantly, the belief in a permanent essential self. When I say an essence instead of a self, it means the heart of who you are, the essence of this thing which you take to be you. That is the cause of states of existence. And if one is asked, is fuel due to a specific cause, this thing which, like the gas, the petrol which drives your vehicle, due to a specific cause, one should say it is. If one is asked, what is the cause for this fuel, one should answer, craving is the cause for this fuel. And I put in here in the brackets a simile, which is also from the text. The Buddha used a simile of a tree growing. He said the sapling or the seed is like the consciousnesses. The field in which it grows, the garden, is called karma. And the sap, the thing which drives it, it is the craving. The craving, you see, fuels the growth of the tree. And it's also, you can see, that craving is actually the cause for the five senses to continue. The craving is the cause for wrong views. Craving is the reason why I do many rites and rituals, not really knowing what they're for, but trying to get something out of them. And of course, the craving, actually, interestingly, the craving creates the idea and the longing for a state, for essential self, an essence of you. If you didn't have craving, you wouldn't need that belief. And so craving is the cause. And if one is asked, is craving due to a specific cause? Craving is the usual translation. One should say it is. If one is asked, what is the cause of craving? One should answer, sensory experience is the cause for craving. Now that word is vedana, and it's often translated as feeling. And I've never liked that word ever since I first saw it, because feeling means something completely different in the English language. It's either an emotion, which has nothing to do with what the word means in Pali, but it can also mean how the body experiences the world. It feels. I can feel the cold of the microphone. I can feel the hardness. It is only specific to the sense of touch, where vedana is... it actually literally means to experience something through any one of the senses. And it is true that sometimes the way it is described is that one aspect of experience, which is the pleasure, the pain, or the in-between. But that is just one aspect of it. The real thing, vedana, so it comes from a Pali word, you know, vedeti. You know, he experiences, he senses, I'm looking for the words, experiences is best the word for it. And vedana is the noun which comes from that verb. So this is actually experience. Sensory experience is a more accurate translation of this thing called vedana. And sensory experience has three types. That's why they call it the pleasant sensory experience, unpleasant sensory experience, or something in between, neutral. That's what this thing called vedana, what it is. It's just sensory experience. And so you can see from this, the sensory experience is obviously what you need to have craving for more of that experience. This daughter is always craving for a pleasant experience. Some people, they like to have unpleasant experiences. They crave to go in death drops at Adventure World or bungee jumpings. Which to me, you can see we can crave for all sorts of things, not just pleasure. Because, you know, just to feel, to experience, is what we want. It's something which is very, very strange to me, but you can understand it. We'd rather experience even pain than have no experience at all. Rather than disappear. To crave, to actually, we crave to be, to experience. And anyway, after that we have, from craving comes from this sensory experience. And if one would ask, is sensory experience due to a specific cause? One should say it is. If one is asked, what is the cause for sensory experience? You should have sensory contact as the cause for sensory experience, which is quite simple. Sensory contact is just turning the switch so the sensory apparatus turns on. And of course, it is also important to understand the way this is looked upon in Buddhism, that the sensory experience is not something which is always, sorry, sensory contact, the senses aren't something which is always there, constant. Basically, they don't exist until they're turned on. Because we always have the idea that consciousness is like a TV set. It's always there, and when you turn it on, it just something appears on the screen which is already pre-existing. But this is not the way it's looked upon in Buddhism. In Buddhism, basically, until you turn the set on, there is no TV. But once it's turned on, once it comes together, then everything turns on. That's the contact. Now, many of these things, reason why it's different is because this is looking at these concepts in a way which was never translated to Western philosophy or Western thought. Western thought came from a different angle, and because of that, you have to get your head around another way of looking at things. So this is not, and it's actually much closer to quantum physics, I must admit, that when you start to talk about the set not existing until there's something on the set. How you don't turn it on. It turns on because of a cause. So what happens with the contact? What is the cause for contact happening? What is the cause for the senses turning on? So it's a good question, but of course that we always think that somebody does the turning on, or that you decide to turn it on, that there's some operator behind the machine. And this is saying, no, it's not an operator behind the machine, it's a total cause and effect relationship. Yes? Totally impersonal, yes. That is actually why the Buddha taught like this, to see its cause and effect, this is how it happens, without having a person, a being, who's on the the mouse of the computer. No ghosts in the machine, unfortunately. Yeah. Exactly. Which is so science. You know, they have, okay, we go quantum physics, they have this smear of probability. You don't exist until someone looks at you. And then you collapse all the probabilities into one eventuality, which we call reality. But it didn't exist. When it says there's an old philosophical question, if a tree falls in a forest and there's no one there to see it or to hear it, does it really fall? And quantum physics answers that, no, it doesn't fall. It doesn't stay up. It's in a smear of probability. 50% standing up, 50% falling over. Yeah. So we don't know. And it makes no sense to say it's standing up. It makes no sense to say it's fallen down. It's a third option, a probability. Once you see it, you create that reality. There's many realities. And because when you see that, you create it. Again,
This is also quantum physics, which again stretches, you know, the way you look at this world. We always think that forest is there for us before we walk in it. What quantum physics is saying is absolute. Actually, that's not really the case. Exactly. That Schrodinger's cat is part of that explanation. It's so similar to... Yeah, so and then until you make the observation, until the mind gets involved and someone sees it, until the contact turns on, only then is the reality created. So this is also, but it's a very deep teaching, how this world is created and how the realms are created, which we're going to go into in a bit more. This is not simple stuff. It's very, very profound, and to get your head around this does change the way you look at things. Profoundly. Yes. Aha! Because this is a fuel which creates aging and death and birth. The sixth sense does not create that, it creates something else. So it can create rebirth, as you don't even call it rebirth later on. Some of these states of existence, you don't get born into them, spontaneously arise there. You just exist in a different realm of existence. You call it different dimension if you like, that's valid statement. And there's no babies or anything, just a being made of mind or made of perception. Yeah, because some of them are including suffering, but if you get rid of the five senses fuel, and you also have to get rid of the other fuels as well, then of course there's rebirth stops, reappearance stops. It's a very good to see, it's only said five senses, and that is actually exactly as it says. It's not a typo. Okay, well that is just, again, that is where perception starts to work. This is going to be coming up later on in this description when it goes into what mentality and materiality are and just how one recognizes things. You know, you do need sort of the training to recognize things in a certain way. It has to actually fit into your views, otherwise you don't recognize it. So basically, it's the way we've been taught. All those times you're in school, they don't just teach you math and English. You learn, culturally, how to see the world. And if you go to a school in Australia, and you go into a school in, say, the Amazon or something, a tribal society, you'll see the world in a totally different way. Fundamentally. I was fortunate in one sense to do my training in a part of Thailand which had never seen Westerners. And I mentioned it was absolutely true, going to some villages, and I was the first white man they'd seen there ever. And, which was fascinating, but also being embedded in that culture as a monk, you weren't a visitor, you were part of the social strata of the village. You had a role, a place, and you soon had to learn that role. And you had to learn a language from inside, which was not a European language. It was an Asian language which had totally different constructs. And it was actually seeing the world from a totally different way. An example of that was, if I call you, if I'm polite to you, I'll call you madam, and I'll of course say Angeli sir. But in those Asian languages like Thai, you don't say that, because I say sir or madam depending on whom I'm addressing. If I'm addressing a boy, I say sir, a female, madam. In Thai, that's not how it works. It depends on who's doing the speaking. So in Thai, I would always call everyone sir. I'd even call Barbara sir, because I'm a man. It doesn't matter who I'm talking to. The sir or madam is about who's doing the talking. And so Barbara, or you would always call me Madam, because you're a girl. So a Madam, it doesn't really depend on who you're talking to. It defines who is doing the talking. So little things like that. It is seeing the language, which is so much involved in the social structures, from a different angle. And it took me a long time to get my head around that. But once you did, you see, this is really interesting. To speak Thai properly, people will say you had to think like a Thai, not like a Westerner. It wasn't just translating. If you want to speak like French or Spanish or something, that's just another Western language. That's very easy. You just translate words. But you've got to go much deeper if you're going to use, say, a Chinese language or something. So anyway, this is getting your head around a different way of seeing things. Yeah, we all have, we see the world, again, through our perceptions. And those perceptions are seen, through our viewpoint of the world, through our culturally or educationally constructed views. Yeah. Well, the thing is, it depends. In a society, we learn sort of an accepted viewpoint so we can talk to one another. And if you say that to too many people, they think you're crazy. So this... Sorry? Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a safe assumption. Yeah. It's a safe assumption, I think. Yeah. Yeah, that's why it creates reality. But anyway, I better get into this without getting off on too many tangents. So, this is especially the idea of contact being the first turning on of sensory experience, and then the experience happens, which is called a Vedana. And they say, if one is asked, is sensory contact due to a specific cause? What actually causes one to see, to hear? I want to say it is. If one is asked, what is the cause for sensory contact? One should answer, mentality, materiality. This is the thing called nama rupa. And that's usually explained, now here we've got the standard explanation of sensory experience, Vedana again, perception, which I was just talking about, volition, contact, attention, that's the mentality part, and the material stuff, books and floors and trees and stuff. And so sometimes, to make it simple for people, I say these are the objects of consciousness, what consciousness can be aware of. But it also shows you that it's also part of the activity of the mind. In order to have any sensory experience, we also need the volition and the perception and attention in particular. We have to actually want to see something. And we move towards turning on our sensory experience. And of course, how we experience things is very much due to our perception, the way we look at things. And to me, that was always one of the most interesting parts of dependent origination. Why does a person fall in love? Their perception is just, number one, they want to. There's a volition that they want to see something beautiful and have a relationship. And then once you have that wanting, that changes the perception to see what you want to see. And of course, If one does not want to see something, or if the volition is you're fed up with that person, then you see all the faults in them, which is what happens when the person you love, you have a divorce with them. And it's amazing how much rubbish you can see in your partner when you're going through a divorce. It was all there to begin with, but now you see what you want to see on the other side. So you can see how volition and perception are sort of creating the way we experience the world. And anyway, mentality and materiality, if one is asked, is that due to a specific cause, one should say it is. If one is asked, what is the cause of mentality and materiality, one should ask that consciousness is. You know, it's the cause, a condition without the consciousness, you will not be able to have mentality, materiality. And you see here that I make a change, which I've often made these days, call it consciousnesses, which is an important change, because when you call it consciousnesses, it comes much more accurately in line with how the Buddha taught. So there's six totally different types of consciousness: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and knowing. Totally different. If I had just written down there consciousness, people would always think that it's just one flow of consciousness, all the same, without making this distinction of different types of consciousnesses. And when you see it's totally different type of consciousnesses, it takes away the illusion that this thing we call consciousness, which is six different types, is a continuous, unbroken flow of your essential self. It's not continuous. One consciousness arises and the other five disappear. And then another one comes up and the other five. It's different types of consciousness. That's why I call them consciousnesses. And just changing a word and giving it a more accurate translation, again, changes the whole way we look at this thing we call life. You are a flow of six different types of consciousnesses, arising and passing away, one coming and the other five disappearing after the other, very fast. But nevertheless, it is discrete, which means that you can never really think or assume that there's a continuous me consciousness always here. And that has profound implications. Exactly. Yes, but it's also that you see that in the causality, one causes the other and the other one causes the other one afterwards. Rolling around each other. Yeah, feedback loop. And, and here's the biggest feedback loop. If one is asked, are consciousnesses due to a specific cause, one should say they are. If one is asked, what is the cause for consciousnesses, one should answer, materiality, mentality is the cause of consciousness. Again, feeding on each other. And the simile which the Buddha used for this in another sutta makes it very clear, because in this particular sutta, this is my assumption, but I think the Buddha was really going for it, making this very, very deep, to teach Ananda a lesson. You know, it's not simple, it's very deep. And so he was going to the deeper aspects of this teaching to put Ananda in his place. But in other sutras, he makes it much easier. He says that consciousnesses and mentality, materiality, namarupa, are like two sheaves of reeds. Or just like after the harvest, you know, you bind up the straw, and in order to dry it, they lean one bundle against the other bundle. And that's a very nice simile, because number one, it's not just one thing, it's a bundle of stuff, consciousness is. And namarupa is another bundle of stuff. And they lean against each other, supporting one another. And he said, that's like consciousness and materiality and mentality. Things like perception and sensory experience. If you take one away, the other one falls over. One cannot exist without the other. So that's how we're saying that mentality and materiality is the cause of consciousness, consciousnesses are the cause of mentality and materiality. The two support one another. You take one away, the other one disappears. Now that's also a very powerful one, because it shows that consciousnesses are not permanent, solid, always there, waiting for something to happen on top of them. If nothing is happening, consciousnesses don't exist. You take away the objects of consciousnesses, materiality, materiality, take that away, consciousness disappears as well. Go on. Oh yeah, and it's not really talking in that area, it's talking something much more fundamental about why that consciousness happened in the first place. But in particular, it's focusing on this delusion that our consciousness is always there. As I was saying, using the simile of the TV set as consciousness and the programs on the TV as mentality and materiality. And that metaphor doesn't work, because if you don't turn on the mentality, materiality, the programs, the TV set's always there. But in consciousness and Nama-rupa, only when you turn on the program does the TV set appear. No program, no TV. No TV, no program. No consciousness, nothing on the consciousness program. Nothing on the consciousness program, no consciousness. Turns off. Sometimes it answers the question people ask. What happens to your sense of self, your soul, your essence of being, when you're under anesthetic? Do you exist when you're under anesthetic? Do you? But do you exist? But there are other people exist, maybe, but not you. Are you? If you are, where do you go? The wave, is that you, or is that just a heartbeat? It's a physical thing. You can still have the engine running, but you're not in the car. And what the Buddha would say is, no, you're not there. Now that's an interesting one. If the five senses stop, does the mind stop? And the answer is actually no, because at least you've got one sense going, one sense consciousness, and that can actually just keep itself going. You know that sometimes in bushfires you have fireballs. And a fireball is just, there's actually no fuel there, in the sense that there's no wood or no leaves which are actually flying through the air. It's actually, it's self-supporting, just with the oxygen in the air, and just a fireball actually can go for a long distance in firestorms. So it can be self-supporting. But with mind consciousness, that can really be self-supporting, as we will see later on, in some of these mind-made realms. Okay. That's the point. It doesn't go anywhere. It was never there anyway. It was just consciousness turning on, and then that disappears. Mind is not some entity which is always there. It turns on, and it's there, and it disappears. It's off. The old simile can't go past that of the flame. The flame is only there because of the candle, the wick, and the heat. One of those just turns off, then the flame, where does it go? you can light it again afterwards. It's like the candle's unconscious, under anesthetic for an hour. But then you turn it on again, it's back again. Where did that flame go in that hour when the candle had been extinguished? It didn't go anywhere. This is the thing. We're changing our whole perception of what a mind is, what consciousness is, what you are. We always think we're just continually flowing through time, unimpeded. Yeah, sometimes we're aware, sometimes we're not aware, but we're still there. But this is saying no. Turns on afterwards when you come out of anesthetic. Different way of looking. Exactly. This is the whole point of this. Yeah, the whole point of this is taking away that conception which we've been brought up with, seeing things in a totally different way. I think what you can explain that as is not the realm of the unconscious, but just the effect of cause and effect. So the causes of the past are not in some big vault of all your memories, but can be accessed. The action at a distance. You can pick up, this is an amazing thing, if you can ever remember a past life, a previous life. How on earth can that happen? Because there's no storage there anyway. It's not stored in your body. You've got a totally different body. It's not stored in the mind. You just access it. You access it like you can access things from a distance. This you're accessing from a distance in time. You just connect with a previous time. Yes, yeah. But it's not stored anyway. Okay. Up to the time from your birth, maybe, or the time in your mother's womb. But from previous lives, no way. So this is the memory of previous lives, which is amazing, but it's there, it's real. And how on earth can that happen? And one of the reasons why people resist that is because they cannot get their heads around sort of seeing that that data, information, can be accessed without it being stored in a cell of the body. I always say it's just the same way. 400 years ago, just people couldn't get their head around the fact this earth was round. That was crazy stuff. People were intelligent, but their perceptual framework, their views, hadn't developed enough to see the world as a sphere. The difference is, again, they have this, and it's apparently very true. There's one case where this was happening in deep meditation. Yes, you can stop all your life faculties. You put an ECG, EEG on you, and there's flat line. The only difference is the body is warm. There's warmth in the body. And the body is still viable. So after deep meditation, after anesthetic or a coma or something, that consciousness can turn on again. And where did it, what's the cause of it turning on? It was actually the last moment before it turned off. Yeah, they all cease, yes. And when that ceases, there's nothing to create the next moment. That is the whole process, is cause and effect, rolling on process. Stop. It's still, the body is still viable. And so, and what actually drives it, this is not part of this talk, what drives anymore, driving the process. What drives the process, what fuels it, is the four Brahma-viharas. Compassion, loving-kindness, sympathetic joy, equanimity. That takes the place of craving, to keep this body going until it's not viable anymore, and then it stops. But that's a totally different aspect. That's the dependent origination from the time of full enlightenment to the parinirvana. What's actually driving that process? And that is compassion. Yes? Yeah. It's very good. Absolutely. So imagine what happens when you don't move. Nothing happens. Or the old joke about Descartes, I think, therefore I am. And then he stopped thinking one day and he vanished. René Descartes, his famous saying, I think, therefore I am. And one day he stopped thinking and disappeared. Okay, I think this probably be about three or four sessions to finish this. Anyway, that is just the summary, the introduction. So let's get going for paragraph three. Now, paragraph three is again this the summary of the summary. Thus, Ananda, with mentality, materiality as a conditioner, are consciousnesses. With consciousnesses as a conditioners, mentality, materiality, the two sheaves of reeds. With mentality, materiality as a conditioners, sensory contact, senses turning on. With sensory contact as a conditioners, sensory experience. We know, we feel, we hear, we see. With sensory experience as a condition, there is craving. With craving as a condition, there is this fuel, a petrol which creates states of existence. With fuel as a condition, there are states of existence. With states of existence as a condition, there is birth. With birth as a condition, there is aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, mental suffering, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this entire mass of suffering. So now we go into it in detail, starting with aging and death. Now, fortunately, until we come down to another page or two, it's pretty easy to understand. But it also makes a very powerful few points. So it starts off, paragraph 4. It was said, with birth as a condition, there is aging and death. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood thus. If there were absolutely and utterly no birth of any kind anywhere, that is, of gods into the states of gods, celestials into the state of celestials, spirits into the state of spirits, demons into the state of spirits, demons into the state of demons, human beings into the state of human beings, four-legged beings into the state of four-legged beings, winged creatures into the state of winged creatures, reptiles into the state of reptiles, each into their own state. If there were no birth of beings of any sort into any state, in a complete absence of birth, with a cessation of birth, would aging and death be discerned? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Therefore, Ananda, this is the cause, source, origin, and condition for aging and death, namely birth. Now, the reason I want to pause on that is because this accurate translation, I think I just followed what Bhikkhu Bodhi said on this one, which is also what you have in your book. Maurice Walsh took that from Bhikkhu Bodhi, exactly the same translation, which is that some people, they try to say that birth is birth in the moment. You're born every moment, and that birth means just the rising of anything. But the whole point of this is to see that what birth means here is birth as every ordinary human being would understand the word in its natural meaning. There's no weird metaphorical meaning intended here by the Buddha. Birth means birth. And the reason we say that is because there had been a controversy, and it continues on, about this dependent origination, this full form. Is it three lifetime, two lifetime, one lifetime theory? And the people who say it's only about one lifetime theory, because you don't need to accept previous lives as a Buddhist, one life is enough. You know, this particular passage here just, you know, shows very, very clearly you cannot maintain dependent origination. It's just a one life phenomenon. Birth means birth. And the Buddha defined this so clearly that no one with a brain could actually interpret this as to be anything else other than things being born. Little chicks coming out of eggs. Sort of babies coming out of the womb. Birth means birth. Yes, we do use that word in English in other meanings. You know, the birth of the blues, for example. Or, you know, an idea was born. Or, you know, you are born every moment, which is, you know, it's a good way of looking at things. Every moment you're born. Or you're a reborn Christian, born again Christian. You have all sorts of ideas of birth, which is okay, because using the fundamental meaning of coming into a state of existence, into a life, that's its fundamental meaning, and you use it in other connotations. But here the Buddha meant birth as birth. So this is the passage when people say it's one life, and said, look, you can't really maintain that. You can use that as another sort of teaching, but origination. He meant birth as birth. Yeah, in the whole universe, yeah. In gods and being gods. And also here, getting the idea. And I support this idea, my understanding, my experience. There are many, many different places to be reborn into. And it's not just animals and insects and human beings. There's many other states of existence. So, paragraph 5. It was said with states of existence as a condition there is birth. How is that so, Ananda, should be understood thus? If there were absolutely and utterly no states of existence of any kind anywhere, that is, no five-sense world existence, that's called karma-loka, five-sense world existence. And that includes our human realm, animal realms, and ghost realms, and other lower realms, and some of the lower heavenly realms. Five material existence, that's called rupa-loka, that is the stage of like the Brahma gods, and also those beings who are basically experiencing one of the jhana states for eons after they die, and immaterial existences. Now, when it calls five material existences, these are called mano-maya-kaya, mind-made existences or bodies, made of mind. Now, this is actually where, again, we extend our concepts, our ideas, of just, you know, what is possible. The mind actually makes these realms, constructs them, and they're mind-made. Now, you may have some experiences of dream states, vivid dream states, you know, imaginary worlds. I cannot remember as a kid having imaginary friends, but I know many people, and they swear to me they did have an imaginary friend when they were a young kid. Was that real? Now, a lot of times, because now we're grown up, and we said, oh, that's just child fantasies. But now I sometimes wonder, was that real or was that not real? And what are the boundaries of reality? And I do remember just reading one book I read as a young man was Alexandra David Neal's Monks and Mystics in Tibet or something. And she tells a story there, and it doesn't seem to have to get any benefit in telling the story of she used her mind to create a being who followed her around. And when I first heard it, I thought, that's crazy stuff. But now, the longer I am a meditator, the power of the mind is quite immense. Can you create things? And of course you can. And a good example of that is, I'm going a bit off the subject now, There are so many Vietnamese refugees who have come to Perth, and I know several of them have told experiences when they've really been in a boat. I remember this one lady saying, in a boat, floating on the oceans, not knowing where they were, just almost dead. If they hadn't been robbed and raped by pirates, they were sinking in the ocean. And they said they saw Kuan Yin coming towards them. And they swear this was Kuan Yin, real, touchable. And then coming to save them, and the next thing they knew, there was a boat coming in from Hong Kong to save them. And was that a delusion because of, heat, tiredness, not enough food? Or was that real? We create reality much more than anybody thinks. Oh, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. You don't have the belief structure, the view structure. But you can see Jesus. Yeah, people saw that. Fishes still remember it. No. I shouldn't be naughty like that. So how much do we actually create? So, and of course when you meditate a lot, it's amazing what you can do. So where were we? Okay, this is five still. These are the types of existences. And now the word Bawa, now I did actually argue with Bhikkhu Bodhi to make this word mean existence, because I quoted in some places they say things like even Manusabhava, which means a state of existence of human being. These are states of existence, what you get reborn into. Now this is the interesting part of this. How much of these states of existence do you make happen? They're not pre-existing states of existence. It's not like a house which is standing empty and you get reborn into it. On the rebirth, you're creating that house, which is a different way of perceiving it. Now that's very easy to understand with things like the immaterial existence and the material existences, because those are mind-made. Immaterial existences are called perception-made. Made of your perception, totally. And material and mind-made is just made of the mind. And also, these mind-made existences and the five sense experiences, these almost they get meshed together in what we call the heavenly realms. But I was trying to talk to someone earlier about this. The heavenly realms are not realms which pre-exist and then you just go and get reborn in there. You create your heavens. It's what you think you deserve, what you want to experience. So if you don't like harp music, you will not have harp. If I went to a heaven realm, it would be electric guitar. That's what I used to like. If you go to a heaven realm, it won't be ambrosia. My heaven realm, fish and chips. But if you don't like fish and chips, don't worry about it, because your heaven realm, you will create it to what you find happiness in. Yeah. Oh, even more so, because here we're very limited on how we can create. Other people just interfere with what we create. So it's just this mesh of people creating different things and limiting us to what we can do. But in that immaterial realm, you create what you want to. So if you want to meet Ainsley, you won't meet Ainsley, but you'll meet your creation of Ainsley in your heaven realm. Yep. Again, suffering is paused, not eliminated. So in such a world, you are again, the experience, because these are, you know, jhana-related states, totally still, just bliss, really high states of happiness. But you cannot say it's the end, because they do fade away, and the suffering is at the end of that. They can end, but at the time you wouldn't know they're going to end. But when they do, that's when you get your payback. You have to pay for that now. Yeah. Ah. Exactly. Now, one of those heaven realms, if you read in the sutta, is Sakha's. Sakha was the same as Indra. He was supposed to be the head of the heaven of the 32. There's 33, sorry, Tawatingsa. The heaven of the 33. And they describe his palace once. And in his palace, now I might get this, the numbers wrong, there are 100 turrets, and every turret has 100 rooms, and every 100 rooms is 100 women waiting to serve their master. Now, it might be happiness for Sakha, but for those women, that would be a hell realm. So, yeah, so are those women pre-existing? Or is that, you know, the creation of this God's fantasy, which I think, given I know men's minds, it is a creation of his fantasy, become real as reality can be in a heaven realm. So we create those beings to associate with us. Yeah, they can come and visit, some of those can visit this realm. But, you know, when they're back up in their own realm, are they with each other or are they with their own creations? So anyway, that's the birth, paragraph 6. Also, I should mention the five sense world of this world. Well, let's actually go down, even ghost realms. Ghost realms are interesting because, again, there you have much more ability to create. What's it like to be a ghost? Half in this world and half in your own creation world. Sort of almost touching, overlapping in this world, but also in your own world as well. We're creating worlds. It's an amazing thing to do. And now that story I told on Friday night, absolutely true story. You can understand now maybe how it works. The guy whose television kept on turning channels, and every time he turned it back again, it would turn onto another channel until he realized it was a ghost. And he solved the problem by getting a second TV. One for the ghost, one for himself. So the ghost is happy, watches its channel, so it doesn't appear what they want to watch. That's a true story. It's laughable, it's jokeable, but you can see, you know, even a ghost can create things. And so the human realm, that's also, this is, I forget, Ajahn Vamadeva was talking about this philosopher. I didn't really read him. I read a little bit about him, but just how, you know, what this really world is. It's this battle of us creating things. And also because, you know, we're limited, we seem to be creating a very similar reality. Which is why we can talk to each other about there is actually a Buddha statue outside. I don't even see that. You see that as well. As if, like, you know, what we can create is limited by our social interactions. And it also explains why if a person goes on a retreat or lives in solitude for too long, then they can create, they're free to create such a personalized reality, they can get totally out of touch with other people's reality. They can't relate. We call them crazy. Are they crazy or they've just got a different reality? Anyway, it was said, paragraph 6, refuel as a condition of our states of existence. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood thus. it was absolutely nothing, no fuel of any kind anywhere. That is, the five senses, wrong views, rites and rituals, and belief in the permanent essential self, in complete absence of these fuels, with a cessation of fuel, would states of existence be discerned? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Therefore, none of this is a cause, source, origin, and condition for states of existence, namely fuel. Now, to explain this, you know, the five senses, they actually create our world. You can see how they create our world here. You know, we want, because we see, you know, we want to see beautiful stuff, which is why we create, you know, what we think is beauty, try and get rid of ugliness or put ugliness behind some institutional doors so we don't see it. We try and create beautiful sounds. We make a world because in the world, it's not the world creates the five senses. The five senses create the world as its playground, where it can explore, where it can be stimulated, where it can have even more experience. So it is the five senses create the world and create states of existence. And because maybe this world is not satisfactory, after a while our five senses create our heaven realms. Which is why all the different heaven realms in all the different religions you see is just elaborations of five senses. You know, the Muslims with I don't know how many virgins or something, just exaggerations of their five sense pleasures. You know, just harp music or rock music or whatever, and ambrosia, just green fields. I was always really, really interested why it was that in the Muslim description of heaven, which I think I read about the first time I read in the Quran, it was beautiful green fields and lots of streams and water. And in the English version of heaven, it was lots of sandy beaches and coconut palms. I thought the Muslims wanted to go to England and the English wanted to go to Saudi Arabia somewhere. And you can see it's just our images of what sort of heaven should be. And it's all sort of based on the sensory pleasures, the five senses. Yeah. We do move, but sometimes we go so far with the five senses and we realize it's endless and it's not getting you anywhere. So then you actually, as you pointed out earlier, the sixth sense, the mind is not mentioned here. Because searching for the happiness in that sense actually leads out of rebirth. The inspiration, compassion, love, deep peace. That is actually leading out of samsara. Yeah. Stillness, yes. Stillness, the mind doesn't move. And who has it said that when you don't move, you don't do anything? Einstein or something. Okay. Now, we've got the other one is the wrong views. You can see just how wrong views actually create more activity, create world. We always have this idea that the more we have, the happier we will be. And as long as we get our economy back on track, then everything will be okay. So basically how many wrong views we have of materialism being the be-all and end-all of happiness in our world. And there's so many other wrong views around. But for those people who ask the question, I hope you thought about it, how do we know that Buddhism is not a wrong view? And the answer is, only when you can get so still, you've got no desire, no ill will, so you're not seeing what you want to see, you're not afraid of seeing what is challenging to you, when you have that mental strength, that it's not going to be distorted by desire and ill will, by wishful thinking and denial. When those two are abolished, even temporarily, that which creates wrong view is put aside. And then you can see clearly. Basically, five hindrances in Buddhism. When they are suppressed, only then can you be sure that what you're seeing, hearing, what you're knowing is accurate. When there's any degree of wishful thinking, desire. Denial, which is fear, is part of denial. When all of that is suppressed by the five hindrances being suppressed, then you can trust that what you understand is accurate. Until that time, you can't trust it. That's why we meditate. And rites and rituals, that was interesting. This is the rites and rituals. It's not just thinking these are going to be a path to nirvana, but those rites and rituals also create our world. They create states of existence. Anzac Day. Chanting Amitofo. People always say this is another Pure Land idea. You chant Amitofo, Amitofo, then you get reborn in the Pure Land. Is that a lot of bunkum or is that true? You'll create that world if you believe it enough. But it's not the way out of existence. Just creating more existence. Another state of existence which a person creates. So that's rites and rituals and belief in the permanent essential self. When you think that you exist, of course you want a place to exist in. It creates more states of existence, any place to exist, rather than just disappearing and vanishing. For many people who don't understand there's nothing here, the scariest thing would be for you to vanish. And in meditation, when you do start vanishing, it becomes really, really scary. Many people get very afraid when they start to disappear. They say, no, it's what you're supposed to do. It's much better after you've disappeared. Anyway, so those are the states of existence. They're the fuels and the cravings. And of course, paragraph 7, it was said with craving as a condition. Well, that's a very good translation. It's the word tanha. It also means like thirst. Just like you've eaten a lot of salt or it's a very hot day and you really need something to drink. And that was the metaphor which the Buddha used and chose the name. Tanha is actually also means thirst. So, you know, these words are not just philosophical, metaphysical words. They were grounded in everyday experience. So, you know, for tanha, craving, it was like thirst. You really need to get something. So, with craving as a condition, there is fuel. So how is that so announced if you understand thus? If there were absolutely and utterly no craving of any kind anywhere, that is no craving for sights, craving for sounds, craving for smells, craving for taste, craving for physical touch, or craving for mental objects, is the craving for any of the six senses, then the complete absence of craving with the cessation of craving will this fuel be discerned, which you know, creates states of existence. Certainly not, venerable sir. Therefore, Ananda, this is the cause, source, origin, and condition for fuel, namely this craving. So you can actually see just when you're thirsty, you have to get that water. And people are almost like thirsty for sights, for sounds. Just, if ever you're bored at home, it's like a thirst. You've got to do something. Turn on the TV. Eat something. Have some sort of stimulation. That is like the thirst, the craving, you can actually feel it. Even for mental objects, sometimes if you're bored and nothing to do, you can lay in bed and fantasize and create mental experiences just because of craving. You're creating these things. So that's the craving. Now, where does craving come from? It is said, with sensory experience as condition, there is craving. How that is so now, it should be understood thus. If there are absolutely and utterly no sensory experience of any kind anywhere, that is no experience born of eye contact, born of ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, born of mind contact, the six senses, then in the complete absence of sensory experience, with a cessation of sensory experience, would craving be discerned? Certainly not, venerable sir. So you need the sensory experience. But if you have the sensory experience, do you have to have craving? Of course not. Because you can have sensory experience without craving, but you can't have craving without sensory experience. And of course, this is one of the places where you can see that this is a cause which, you know, they say is not necessary, but it's called sufficient. If any of you did any philosophy, necessary and sufficient conditions. So you need wood, or you need fuel to have a fire, but just because you have fuel doesn't mean you have a fire. So fuel is necessary, but it's not sufficient. You need something more. And of course, the other thing you need for sensory experience to create craving, again, is things like delusion. But anyway, without those senses, there would be no sensory experience, and then therefore, so without the sensory experience, there would be no craving. Now, here in this particular sutta, the Buddha goes on an interesting digression here, which is, I think, is good for us, because deep so far, this is much easier to understand, and it just is much more relating to everyday life. So thus, Ananda, in dependence upon sensory experience, there is craving. Dependent upon craving, there is, now he goes on to a tangent here. In dependent upon sensory experience, there is craving. And also, in dependence upon craving, there is pursuit. In dependence upon pursuit, there is gain. Dependent upon gain, there is judging. In dependent upon judging, there is desire and lust. In dependent upon desire and lust, there is attachment. In dependent upon attachment, there is possessiveness. In dependent upon possessiveness, there is stinginess. In dependent upon stinginess, there is safeguarding. And because of safeguarding, various evil, unwholesome experiences originate. The taking up of clubs and weapons, conflicts, quarrels and disputes, insulting speech, slander and falsehood. So it's actually he's taking from sensory experience craving and seeing how that leads to something much more worldly problems. And now he decides to explain it all. It was said because of safeguarding, various evil, unwholesome experiences originate. The taking up of clubs and weapons, conflicts, quarrels and disputes, insulting speech, slander and falsehood. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood thus. If there were absolutely no safeguarding of any kind anywhere, in the complete absence of safeguarding, the cessation of safeguarding, would those various evil, unwholesome experiences originate? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Therefore, Ananda, this is the cause, source, origin, and condition for those various evil, unwholesome experiences, namely safeguarding. You see what this safeguarding means by from where it comes from. Now, you're safeguarding your reputation, safeguarding your possessions, and safeguarding maybe your career or whatever it is. It is, you know, when we value these things so much, just like jewelry, we won't share it. And so what happens, the old simile, if you take like a diamond or gold especially, you dig it out from the ground, you buy it, and then you bury it in the ground in a vault somewhere. Starts off in the ground, ends up in the ground. What are you doing that for? Leave it in the ground to begin with. But that's not our world. And so we safeguard these things. And because of safeguard, that's why we have inequality of what we safeguard and fear. And that means we have all these problems. And it was said, 11, and depend upon stinginess there is safeguarding. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood thus. If there is absolutely nothing, no stinginess of any kind anywhere, in the complete absence of stinginess, with the cessation of stinginess, would safeguarding be discerned? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Therefore, Ananda, this is the cause, source, origin, and condition for safeguarding, namely stinginess. And, of course, you can understand what that means. It was said, depend upon possessiveness there is stinginess. Actually, because this is repeated, I will just go from one to the other, unless it's something which is very important to stop at. How is that should be understood? If there was absolutely nothing, no possessiveness of any kind, absence of possessiveness, would stinginess be discerned? No. So the cause of stinginess is possessiveness, and attachment is the cause of possessiveness. And this is not the upadana, this is another word called ajosana. The word which is actually bringing towards yourself, owning it. So attachment, there is possessiveness. And it depends upon what's the cause of possessiveness? Attachment. It is said, depend upon desire and lust, there is attachment. How that is so, and that should be understood thus, that there is absolutely nothing, no desire and lust of any kind anywhere. In the complete absence of desire and lust, with the cessation of desire and lust, would attachment be discerned? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. So if you didn't desire anything, want anything, then there would be no attachment to things. And you'd just be able to, for example, you have some water, you can drink it in the river, you're not attached to it, so you're not stingy about it, you don't fight wars over the water, like sometimes people do, because it's my water. And, 15, it was said, and depend upon judging, there is desire and lust. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood that thus. If there was absolutely and utterly no judging of any kind anywhere, then the complete absence of judging, with the cessation of judging, would desire and lust be discerned. Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Therefore, Ananda, this is the cause, source, origin, and condition for desire and lust, namely judging. And that's an interesting little observation of the Buddha. Now, then we always have this judging. This is good, this is bad, I'm better than the other person, I deserve more. There's all that thinking, that discriminatory thinking of called judging, they say, which is underneath all the desire and lust one has. If one looks in the newspaper about the new car, one judges it before one wants it and goes out to buy it. If you are a young man or a young woman, you look at that guy, you judge them first of all before you go and start talking to them and want them. So there's all this thinking and judging which happens before desire and lust, which is why, you know, I teach the young monks. Now you see someone, don't judge them. This is beautiful. This is ugly. Don't judge that this is a really, really good iPad. And the other ones are just so old. Because as soon as you start judging like that, you want it. It was said dependence upon gain is judging. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood thus. If there is absolutely and utterly no gain of any kind anywhere, in the complete absence of gain, with the cessation of gain, you wouldn't need to judge anything. Therefore, Ananda, this is the cause, source and origin for judging, namely gain. It was said dependent upon pursuit there is gain. You go for it, and then you get it, and then you judge it. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood thus. If there are absolutely and utterly no pursuit of any kind anywhere, then the complete absence of pursuit, the cessation of pursuit, would gain be discerned, certainly not, Venerable Sir. So this is the cause, source, and origin, and condition for gain. And it was said in dependence upon craving there is pursuit. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood thus. If there is absolutely nothing, no craving of any kind anywhere, no craving for sense pleasures, no craving for existence, no craving for non-existence, the three types of cravings, then the complete absence of craving for the cessation of craving will pursuit be discerned. So therefore, Ananda, this is the cause, source, origin, and condition for pursuit, namely craving. So craving, before I go into the last sentence, in this little tangential cause and effect, because of craving, there is pursuit. Because of pursuit, there is a possibility of gain. Because of gain, there is a judging. Because of judging, there is desire and lust. Desire and lust, there is attachment. Attachment, possessiveness. Possessiveness is stinginess. Stinginess, safeguarding. Safeguarding, various evil, unwholesome things originate. Taking up of clubs and weapons, conflicts, quarrels, dispute, insulting speech, slander, and falsehood. So the final statement here, the sentence, thus, Ananda, these two pathways of craving, one leading to fuel, leading to states of existence, etc., and the other one leading to pursuit and wars, emerge from the same sensory experience. So just the Buddha going on a different tangent there. Now, going back to the dependent origination. Feeling. Oh, actually, I should have... that's a typo there. That should be sensory experience. 19. It was said, with sensory contact as a condition, there is sensory experience. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood thus. If there were absolutely and utterly no sensory contact of any kind anywhere, that is no sight contact, hearing, smell, taste, touch, mind contact, in complete absence of sensory contact, which is again the senses turning on, with the cessation of sensory contact, would sensory experience be discerned? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Therefore, Ananda, this is a cause, source, origin, and condition for sensory experience, namely sensory contact. That's easy. Now, the next one is probably the most difficult paragraph here. This is contact. See how this turning on the sensory operations, called sensory contact, turning on the senses, is caused by the existence of mentality, materiality. And it was said, with mentality, materiality, nama rupa is conditioned, there is sensory contact. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood thus. if those features, marks, signs, and indicators by which mental phenomena may be discerned, so mental phenomena needs features, marks, signs, and indicators, you know, the sensory experience, perception, volition, contact, attention, to be able to know those, they have their particular features and signs. If they were all absent, would mental experience appear in the material body? You know, in this body of yours, sitting here right now. If those mental phenomena, that mentality didn't exist, you wouldn't be able to know anything. Certainly not, Venerable Sir. And it's interesting here, they call this designation contact. This is they call that particular contact, just which occurs in the mind. To know something, you've got to give it a designation, a name, a feature, or something. So that's what the Buddha was saying here. And if those ways of knowing something did not exist, then you would be not able to know anything in this material body. In earth, those features, marks, signs, and indicators by which the material body will be discerned were all absent, would the five sense experiences appear in the mind? This is the five senses, again, need names, need descriptions, need features. This is actually how we learn to see. We're told, man, woman, tree. And without that language, could we really see? And I remember, I remember reading an article about someone who was blind since birth. And I forget exactly what the condition was, but it could be rectified. But I think at this time they were maybe teenager, so their eye was actually repaired, so they could actually see. The physical function of the eye was repaired, but they could make no sense at all of what was actually occurring. They could see, but they could not make sense of it. They couldn't interpret it. They hadn't learned from that early age how to use that sense. It was too late for them. So that's interesting in the sense that this is where we do need those names and designations to be able to use a sense. Without that learning about how to know sound, know what sound actually means, the language, which we usually learn when we're kids. If we don't learn those signs and features, then basically that even it says here that the impingement contact, which is just impingement contact is what happens with the five senses, impinges on the eyes, impinges on the ears, impinges on the body. And if we didn't have those marks, signs and indicators by which this were known, we could not have sensory experience. It wouldn't be known. So what it's actually saying, we do need the mentality, materiality, to even have contact, to be able to make sense of it, to actually basically, yeah, we're sort of seeing, but it's not really seeing because we haven't got a clue what's going on. It's not contact. And now, as usual, the Buddha puts these together. If those features, marks, signs, and indicators by... I'll start this again. This is paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4. If those features, marks, signs, and indicators by which mental experience and five sense experience may be discerned were all absent, so mental experience and five sense experience, all those marks and features totally absent, would either mind contact or five sense contact be discerned? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. If those features, marks, signs, and indicators through which there is a description of mentality, materiality, were absent, would contact be discerned? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. So you do need mentality, materiality, you know, to be able to have contact. Otherwise, if there even was some rudimentary form of contact, it would make no sense and would just disappear. This is a cause, origin, and condition for sensory contact, namely mentality, materiality. It was said, with consciousness as a condition, there is mentality, materiality. Where am I going now? This page. Oops. Should be 21. Uh-oh. Here we go. Thank you so much. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood thus. And I've got if the stream of. The stream of is not mentioned there, it just says consciousnesses. So as it says in the suttas, if consciousnesses were not to descend into the mother's womb, would mentality and materiality develop in the womb? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. And again, this is actually showing just how this dependent origination is not just in a moment, but it's actually showing the process of rebirth even. And this is pretty accurate. It's an accurate translation. Consciousness descending into the mother's womb. Call it a stream of consciousness makes it a bit more accurate, and that's how the Buddha would often describe it, as vijnana sota, stream of consciousnesses. The stream of consciousness not descend into the mother's womb, but mentality, materiality, the objects of consciousness on which contact can develop. Would that develop in the womb? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. And this is the idea, you know, in Buddhism. At a certain time after conception until sort of birth, a stream of consciousness from the previous life actually enters the mother's womb and enters that being. Until that time, that fetus developing in the mother's womb, for its existence, is basically dependent upon the mother's consciousness and mentality, materiality. It's literally part of the mother. But as soon as that separate consciousness from previous life enters the mother's womb, then it becomes an independent being. You may all know the myth, which we'll probably talk about in 2 weeks' time on Waisak, of the Buddha's mother, Queen Maya, or whether she was a real queen or not. But anyway, having the dream of an elephant coming into her womb. Now, an elephant was a symbol of a great being entering her womb. And that was considered to be like the moment when the being actually entered the mother's womb and the fetus became an independent entity. And that has actually been described by people who remember past lives, who remember entering the womb of a pregnant woman. And other monks have seen that. That story I tell you, I told in other talks, about this monkey who was adopted by a monastery in the northeast of Thailand. And because it lived in a monastery, you know, it actually did everything the monks would do, and almost thought it was a monk, so every tea time you'd have to give this monkey a cup of tea. And it would be there with the monks drinking its tea while the monks were having their tea in the afternoon. It would always be there. It would always be associated, you know, with the monks. And one day it was chasing a car. Actually, it was a truck outside the monastery, trying to keep the monastery quiet. And, of course, it fell under the wheels and was killed. And the abbot, who's a very, very highly respected monk, you know, he told the other monks afterwards, he shouldn't say these things because then this story goes around. He said, yeah, he saw it all happening. He was meditating at the time. And he saw the stream of consciousness of this monkey go into the village and go into the first available womb. There was one of the women in the village who was pregnant, and enter the womb. The stream of consciousness entering the womb. And because all the monks knew the story that this was the monkey before, they were always really interested to wait until this being was born from this villager. Because this is the village, you know, you go there on arms round, do all the ceremonies for people, they come there on the holy days, so, you know, you're part of the village. And they told me afterwards, when the baby was born, say, was it different in any way? And what they said to me was, it was unusually hairy. It was a monkey before. And that must have been a terrible thing to do, because imagine, the word would get around to everyone in the village, and that poor kid, when he went to school, you know, yeah, you're a monkey, we knew you before, he'd get very badly teased. But that's a stream of consciousness going to a mother's womb. No. Yeah. And the reason I say that is because there's some people who claim to remember their past lives and being investigated by, quoted from Ian Stevenson's book, and just very, very compelling information to say that yes, they were reborn. And it was only like a day or two before the birth of the next life. So sometimes you can get reborn, you know, almost pretty quickly if there is a womb available. I can feel the movement, but whether that is a new being coming in, that's interesting. If any mothers have had those experiences, maybe because it's not part of Western culture, maybe they don't have an experience and they discount it straight away. I don't know, maybe sometimes you do have an experience that one day you have some special dream that something's coming into you. Maybe that is the time. But this is the Buddhist way of understanding. It's a stream of consciousness that actually enters the mother's womb, if it's free. Here we go. And if after descending into the womb, the stream of consciousnesses were to depart, would mentality materiality develop into this present state of being? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. And if the stream of consciousness of a young boy or girl were to be cut off, would mentality materiality grow up, develop and reach maturity? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Therefore, Ananda, this is the cause, source, origin and condition for mentality materiality. Consciousness. So you do need the consciousness to support the mentality materiality. And just on that story, I don't mind telling you a nice interesting story that this was told to us by Dira Yupa Ping Pong, you know, who comes in very often. And she told me that there's a very famous monk in Thailand, and he told his story. He said there was a young boy, only sort of 3 or 4 or 5 years of age or something, and he went down to the local lake by the village. This was, you know, a remote village in Thailand. And you go down to the lake to get water, you know, because that's the only water you do, the local village pond, and he fell in. And I think his sister saw him fall in, and so ran to the village to get someone to help. And this was in the morning, getting water in the morning. And they searched for him, they didn't find him till late afternoon. And, you know, he'd been under the water for hours, so he should be totally dead. But they dragged him out of the water. They felt that he was warm. They dragged him back, and you know, the water started coming out of his body, and he woke up, he came to again. He survived, you know, many hours underwater, which was really quite amazing. But his experience of this was that he knew nothing about the time before he was dragged out. All he remembered was seeing this incredibly beautiful light and then appearing in this body being dragged out from the lake back into the village. For him, that was the beginning of his birth. And as I understand that, I would say that that first being died underwater, but the body was still viable. So this being is a very, very special being. You know, took that little boy's body, still viable, went into it so he could do, you know, his duty, his job in this life, being a great meditation teacher. Interesting. This was a case, I say, I may be wrong, but the evidence is pretty compelling, that entered not even a mother's womb, but entered a body which was still viable after 2, 3, 4 years of life. Interesting. Yeah. This is the stream of consciousness. This is the mind-made body. This is how it appears. This is how the person experiences it. This is how you might say the stream of consciousness attaches to that being. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But this is how people perceive it. The people whose consciousness it is, or the people who associate with that stream of consciousness later on in their life, that's how they remember it in their perceptions. And it's the case of the Buddha. The Buddha's mother, she also perceived it as an elephant coming in. It's not an elephant goes into your body. An elephant cannot fit in there. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah. A being coming into one's world. Yeah, so many cultures have that idea of a being coming into the mother's womb. The stream of consciousness, yes, is associated and it supports, you know, that development of that being in the womb. Associations, just like your stream of consciousness is, you know, supports you. And if your stream of consciousness left your body, you'd be dead. Interestingly, if it goes for too long, how long will you be viable? Can you use the mic? Okay. Because this is put online, so people don't understand what I'm answering if you don't know what the question is.
In the case of, you know, near-death experiences where people experience moving away from their body, their physical body is still there, but they're somewhere else.
Okay, the stream of consciousness
is... Is that the stream of consciousness?
Yes, very much so. Stream of consciousness, near-death experiences, leaving the body. If your body is still viable, you can get back in again. But if your body is not viable, then no doorway to get back in.
So in theory then, I believe that some people can just, you know, leave their body whenever they...
Whenever they want to,
they have
yeah.
the skill to be able to do
that. Yeah, they can do that.
So there's not necessarily...
Indeed, but your body has to be viable if you leave your body for too long, because your body is viable sometimes. Mm. People are afraid of this in Asia, that somebody else might sort of say, oh, there's a vacant room there. You know, like you do squats in the West, there's a house, you don't really own the house, but no one there, so you get in there and squat. So squatting is a possibility.
And the other area that this sort of touches on is the mind-made body. How does that relate to...
This is a mind-made body, because when your stream of consciousness leaves at a near-death experience, many times that people feel that they have, you know, eyes and ears... Mm. And you know, it seems to be positioned in the right place. You only have two eyes, not in the back of your head or the front of your head or anywhere. And when people see that person who's left the body, ghosts, the amazing thing is that they see you as you were dressed when you're dead, or as you're in your coffin. You even assume the clothes you're wearing at the time. Your mind-made body is not just the same age, it's got the same hairstyle, it's the same clothes as well. You make that because that's what you assume you are. And other people see that.
Thank you.
Okay. Just one last paragraph, because it's a nice place to end. Just before we go to the descriptions of one's essential self, and that will be on the 29th. Consciousness, it was said, with mentality, materiality is conditioned, there is consciousness. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood thus. If the stream of consciousnesses were not to gain a footing in mentality, materiality, would an origin of the mass of suffering of future birth, aging and death be discerned? Certainly not, venerable sir. So, the stream of consciousness needs to gain a footing in mentality, materiality. Mentality, materiality needs consciousness to survive. So if the stream of consciousness actually doesn't get a footing in mentality, materiality, then this being, this body, this human being, cannot sort of survive. Therefore, now, this is the cause, source, origin, condition for consciousness, is namely mentality, materiality. So that's a deeper description. If one is confused by that, just call consciousness the screen and mentality, materiality the objects. You can't just be conscious without conscious of something. There's nothing to be conscious of, then consciousness disappears. And just the last little paragraph, which is a nice place to finish. It is to this extent, Ananda, that one can be born, age and die, pass away and re-arise. Now this is important because it gives the whole reason for dependent origination. How one can be born, age, die, pass away and re-arise. I always understood dependent origination to be answering a question which I often get from people who are experiencing Buddhism for the first time. How can you have rebirth when there is no being to get reborn? When there's no self, there's no essence. How can you do that? If you want to get reborn, you have to get something to be reborn. And the whole point of dependent origination is to see that this being is just a process. And dependent origination, how this process goes on, and especially how it goes on from the death into the next life. It's explaining how, if you like, reincarnation or rebirth happens without the necessity of a self or a soul or an essence which has to be reborn. It is to this extent, Ananda, that one can be born, age and die, pass away and re-arise. To this extent, there is a pathway for designation, there is a pathway for language. To this extent, there is a pathway for description. Language descriptions can only go so far. And of course, you know, sometimes that those words, we cannot see their full meaning. But that's as best you can do. To this extent, there is a sphere of wisdom. To this extent, the round turns for describing the state of being. That is, when there's mentality, materiality together with consciousness, those two coming together, you're saying, describe this whole process, which we call life, and the process to our next life. The coming together and the self, the supporting one another of consciousnesses and things to be conscious of. Okay, now I'm going to finish there for today. So, descriptions of one's essential self, that just goes on a different area. It's a good place to finish. There may be some questions from overseas. I'll take those first, and then some old questions from people here. And remember how this started? Ananda said, oh, it's so easy to understand, it's so clear. And the Buddha said, no. And I think he's proved that. Okay. First, what is the difference between mindfulness and consciousness? Again, consciousness is, the different types of consciousness is, and mindfulness is an aspect of the sixth consciousness, the mental consciousness, when it has volition, which is pointing the mind to a certain area, and a clear perception of it. So mindfulness is part of mentality. In mentality, materiality, consciousness is something else. Is quantum philosophy a good approach to explain the spiritual or mental realms? I think quantum philosophy is still a work in progress. And again, to really understand what you're talking about, because I've read a lot of books which are total gobbledygook, by people who haven't had the training in physics, so they haven't really got their head around what quantum science is really trying to tell. If you haven't done the math and really got your head around it, you can make all sorts of very weird assumptions when you haven't really got the basis to do that. So I would actually, if you have done some theoretical physics and you're trained in quantum science, then okay, it may be a good approach. Not to explain the spiritual and mental realms, but to actually to get a better perspective of them. And lastly, in the suttas there is a line, whatever arises is subject to cessation, referred as the stainless eye of the Dhamma, is seen through the process of causation, referring to this. Exactly, because what causation means, if it's caused, it's subject to arising. It's subject to being caused. Whatever has a cause is subject to arising. So all the things which have causes, when the causes vanish, then the effect vanishes as well. So everything we've talked about, consciousnesses, has its cause, mentality, materiality. So consciousnesses, they're subject to arising, they're not always there. They're subject to arising, therefore they're subject to cessation. And cessation doesn't mean just for a few seconds. To cease means to cease forever. So consciousnesses are subject to cessation forever. Mentality, materiality, subject to cessation forever. Craving, birth, subject to cessation forever. Old age, subject to cessation forever. Those of you who are old, please don't do this again. Getting old once is enough. So yes, exactly. That's dependent origination is part of the stainless eye of Dhamma. That's why one of the great sayings of the Buddha, whoever sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. Whoever sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. It's essential. Yes, John. Oh, Mara is really upset at the monks at Bodhinyana Monastery. Because Mara's very upset at us. Because we're teaching Dhamma. Mara. He's trying to do all sorts of things to stop us. So, because Mara does try and stop you seeing these things. This fellow, Mara, he's the head of the Deva realm, a very high, powerful being. Paranimitta Vasavati, the head of the heavenly beings who control other people's creations. The control freak in chief, I call him. The one who controls you and tries to think that you are in control, your will. You think that your will is coming from you, that you have choice. Mara is manipulating you. And the way that Mara manipulates, like he manipulated the Buddha before his enlightenment. First of all, fear. The army of the Buddha. Sometimes fear causes will control. Governments use that. Fear of terrorism, take away all of your freedoms. CCTV cameras everywhere. Trying to get into your mobile phone, checking everything you're doing. Fear leads to control. And we do that too. We're afraid. Therefore we try to control our environment. First of all, fear, that never worked with the Buddha. And so then lust, sort of Mara's daughters trying to get him to sort of get hot. But Buddha was not controlled by desire or by fear. And then conceit. The Mara said, who do you think you are sitting on this spot? Now you don't deserve to sit under the Bodhi tree. And the Buddha said, no, touching the earth to bear witness that I deserve to be here. Sometimes self-doubt, lack of self-worth, all Mara stuff. I'm not good enough to become enlightened. That's Mara speaking. So Mara does get involved a lot. Yeah. Oh no, that's his friends, his assistants. Yeah. Corrupted by power. Oh yeah. Indeed, it's very, very high realm. Powerful people in our world have to have lots and lots of good karma. You know, somehow or other, Mr. Trump, you know, he has to have lots and lots of good karma from the past to get, you know, being a billionaire and get to that position of power. So it's sometimes we misuse our good karma. Just like people misuse their wealth. Power corrupts. trouble with our political system. We don't sort of have checks and balances on power. We open the door to more and more corruption. Because it's the nature of things, power does corrupt. Yes?
Back on page 2, existence,
paragraph 6. Oh, grucky. Yeah? Yeah.
Defining rites and rituals with false views and false beliefs. Do we have to do with rites and rituals?
Exactly. Original Buddhism had very, very few rites and rituals at all. We never sort of used to do any chanting. We didn't, like today, I had to, two babies. It's a Thai tradition that their first haircut has to be done by a monk. So I had to snip their hair, and this little baby was moved. It was really a close thing when I snip its ear off. Or yeah. Yeah. Well, again, that's a bit sort of conceited because Mahayana does enough rituals. And we do rituals as well. But as long as they're rituals which you know their meaning, like I say, bowing. So it's not just an empty rite and ritual. Yeah, good. Yes, maybe this is the last question because it's getting late. Yes. Okay, call them the higher realms, but they all have some suffering to them. Lower realms, they say, more suffering than happiness. The human realm, believe it or not, is a well balanced. Some happiness and some suffering. And the higher realms, they say, a lot of happiness and not so much suffering, but still have some suffering. Always dukkha somewhere. You can't get away from it. Excellent. I always thought that being a monk, then I wouldn't have any dukkha anymore. But I have monk dukkha. When you're a senior monk, you think, oh, now you can do everything you want, you've got power. But now you have senior monk suffering. So anyway. Okay, let's pay respect to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. It's almost 5 o'clock now. Oh, yes. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And now let's bow 3 times to the Buddha. A nice ritual.
Arahaṁ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṁ bhagavantaṁ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṁ namassāmi suppatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sanghang Namami.
Well, you don't wait for me. You get yourself together and get in the car. And please keep these for next 3 weeks' time, so we don't have to redo them. And please, not too many questions, because I have to rush off back to monastery. Yeah. Yay! Well done. Yeah. Do. I told you that you're a good girl. And you can do it. You can do whatever you want. Okay. Hi. Yeah? Excellent.